From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Indonesia has a new president, but the power of the military remains unbroken. Today we'll go to Jakarta to find out just who Gus Dur is and what he means for democracy and human rights. Also, memories of slavery. The late John Henrik Clark discusses 500 years of African history, and Dr. Ivan Van Sertima, author of They Came Before Columbus, looking at African-American history. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Virginia has executed a man convicted of killing a sandwich store clerk to get money for drugs. In a final written statement, 27-year-old Jason Joseph apologized for the anguish he'd caused the victim's family and his own. He ended the note with the words, "No more pain." He was given a dose of lethal drugs last night. Joseph's lawyers had pushed for clemency, arguing his jury had been influenced by false and highly inflammatory media reports and that jurors were not allowed to hear medical evidence. In this news from California, a former prisoner sobbed uncontrollably as he described how he was raped by a cellmate and then laughed at by guards when he asked to be transferred to another cell. Four guards are on trial for allegedly setting up the rapes at the Corcoran State Prison, one of the most notorious in the country, to punish Eddie Dillard for kicking a guard at another prison. The guards, who are on paid leave, face up to 9 years in prison if convicted. Dillard is a slightly built, now 28-year-old, attending junior college in Southern California. He said he protested as soon as he was told he'd be sharing a prison cell with Wayne Robertson, known as the Booty Bandit. He said his protest continued until he was ordered in the cell. He said, "Before I knew it, we were getting into it. We were tussling, and he said he was going to rape me. I tried to fight him off, but I couldn't. He raped me," he said, his voice cracking. Dillard also said guards asked whether he was gay, laughed at his pleas for help, and later threatened to put him back in the cell if he complained about what happened. The judge eventually called a recess because Dillard was crying so much that his voice was barely audible. This news from Tokyo, a high-ranking defense agency official resigned today after a suggestion that Japan should consider arming itself with nuclear weapons came under heavy criticism. Shingo Nishimura, a parliamentary vice minister for defense, handed in his resignation to Prime Minister Keizo Obuchi, an official at the premier's office said on condition of anonymity. The hawkish political appointee said in an interview with Weekly Playboy magazine that parliament should consider the fact that Japan may be better off that it armed itself with nuclear weapons. Railroad officials offered today to remove fresh concrete plastered on the bridge under which hundreds of Korean refugees were allegedly killed by American troops in the Korean War. South Korea's National Railroad spent $55,000 in September to coat one of the bullet-scarred railroad tunnels at Nogunri, South Korea, with a 4-inch layer of concrete. That invited charges of a government cover-up from South Koreans who considered the bullet marks as evidence of their claims that GIs machine-gunned unarmed Korean refugees seeking shelter beneath the railroad overpasses in July of 1950. Associated Press did an expose on the story several weeks ago, and a number of GIs admitted that that's precisely what they did. Nelson Mandela and Yasser Arafat greeted each other yesterday as old friends do, hugging, talking over old times, and calling in some favors. The trip to the Gaza Strip was the last stop on the recently retired South African president's Mideast tour, and it was his most effusive reception. In the 70s, Mandela and the ANC forged ties with other movements struggling for self-determination, including Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization. For Israelis, Mandela's visit to the Jewish state, which ended earlier Monday, was an important sign of reconciliation. Mandela said he felt the time was right now that the Mideast peace process has been revived by a newly elected moderate government headed by Ehud Barak. The U.S. military failed to inform Israel about its inquiries into mechanical faults in the Apache attack helicopter, which later caused a fatal crash in Israel, this according to the Israeli military. Today, Israel Radio says this was one of the findings of the Israeli inquiry into the crash in which a flight mechanic was killed and the pilot injured. The accident happened in southern Israel June 1st. Pat Buchanan says he can win the presidency given the right circumstances. The GOP presidential candidate is expected to join the Reform Party next week. He says he could capture the White House if he were allowed into a three-way debate with the Republican and Democratic nominees. And the Republicans yesterday killed a bill to curtail the role of money in campaigns for the fourth straight year. The doomed measure would have banned soft money, the unlimited campaign contributions that corporations and individuals give to political parties. Some call it bribes. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Indonesia's parliament today elected Muslim leader Abdurrahman Wahid as the new president of Indonesia after dealing a humiliating political blow to President Habibie, who withdrew from the race. Wahid, whose political shrewdness helped him to outmaneuver the woman long held to be the frontrunner for president, Megawati Sukarno-Putri, now faces the daunting task of leading the world's fourth largest country out of its worst economic crisis in a generation, and faces tens of thousands of students and workers who continue to demand that the power of the military be broken. We turn now to Jakarta, Indonesia, to John Rosa, who is a historian of South and Southeast Asia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, can you start off by telling us about the response to this latest news that was just announced hours ago? The leader, Muslim leader, Abdurrahman Wahid, known as Gus Dur, is not the person that people have been saying they expected to become the next president of Indonesia.
No, everyone expected Megawati to win, especially the supporters of her party, the PDIP. And they are very shocked by this development. It was a close vote. There was 373 votes for Gus Dur and 313 for Megawati. And it's very difficult for people to understand how it could be that Megawati, his party, won plurality of votes, and his party so far has not gotten any position in the government. You know, the heads of the two parliamentary bodies went to other parties. Everyone expected that Megawati would be the president. So it comes as a great shock. And her supporters now, against her wishes, are taking the streets and protesting. And in central Java, in the city of Solo, they've taken over the building of the city administration. And there's the fires there, and there's some fires as well near the parliamentary building here in Jakarta.
We're talking to John Rosa. He is a historian of South and Southeast Asia, and we're speaking to him in Jakarta. John, can you talk more about the protests outside? I was listening to the BBC earlier this morning as they describe an explosion that went off and then security confronting, the Indonesian army confronting Megawati Sukarno-Putri's supporters that were outside the parliament, shocked by the latest news.
I'm not quite sure. There was a bombing, rather small bomb that wasn't all that important. Injured several people at a hotel, the Hotel Indonesia, earlier today. But then after the vote, there were a group of, I think it was five of her supporters who came to the parliamentary building and asked to meet with her, and she refused to meet with them. It wasn't just that security prevented them from meeting with her, but that she refused to meet with them. And after the vote, Gus Dur got up front of the parliament and said that he was going to go to the Hotel Indonesia traffic circle, where there have been many of these demonstrations led by Megawati's party and other groups as well, and to a traffic intersection just down the road from the parliamentary building, where there's been a lot of demonstrations as well. And he and Megawati were supposed to go there. They promised that they would go there to speak to the masses, but they didn't. Instead, Gusto went over to Habibi's house and spoke with Habibi. So they have not yet really spoken to the people to explain what happened with this vote and how could it be Megawati lost.
John, we only have a minute, and I wanted to ask you about the real significance about whether or not Gusdur, who is now president, or whether it was Megawati Sukarnoputri or even Habibi, the whole issue of the power of the military not being broken and what Gusdur means for this.
Well, it doesn't look very good for the people in Indonesia who are struggling against the military. The military appears to have supported Gusdur, a secret ballot in the parliament. We don't know who exactly supported him, but it was clear that the right Muslim groups supported him. Golkar, the former ruling party, the Harto supported him. And it appears the military did it. And the military is hoping to use him to battle the United Nations Commission of Inquiry into crimes against humanity and war crimes in East Timor. And there's a general who's already said that he's counting on Gusdur to help the military in this. And it is likely that Gusdur will be able to be used by these groups. If I can explain just a minute more, he was nominated by a coalition of right-wing Muslim parties. His own party did not nominate him for the presidency. His own party was supporting Megawati. He earlier was supporting Megawati, but he accepted this nomination nonetheless. Within his religious organization, the NU, many people are supporters of Megawati. So he's accepted a nomination from people who are not really his own supporters. And he, over the next 5 years, if he lasts that long, he's in very ill health, he could well be used by the Muslim groups, by the right-wing Muslim groups, and by the military for their own agenda. He's going to be a weak president, given his ill health, given his reliance upon other people, given his rather unpredictable mercurial behavior. So there's a great deal of danger ahead here.
And meanwhile, John Rosa, Shanana Gushmal, the rebel leader of Timor, we expect to be the first founding president of an independent Timor, hailing the Indonesian parliament's basically rubber stamp of the self-determination referendum that took place on August 30th, saying that East Timor is no longer a part of Indonesia.
Yeah, it really went down to the wire. We thought that the parliament might continue to insist upon these conditions before revoking the parliament's decree of 1978 that integrated East Timor with Indonesia. But they appear to have gotten some better sense and decided to approve the revocation of that decree without any conditions. It was a surreal scene for the past couple of weeks, as this commission and the people within the commission were refusing to approve the revocation of this decree, even though the foreign ministry and the military and Golkar, Bibi, were asked to approve it. Groups that have been traditionally on the furthest, the most supportive of the integration of East Timor, the colonization of East Timor, we're actually trying to get a new democratically elected parliament, a commission of that parliament, to revoke this decree. It was a surreal scene. This commission consisted of politicians who were largely just trying to get back at Habibi, and I think who were also very ignorant, like many other Asians, about East Timor, and continue to think that East Timor was a legitimate part of Indonesia and There was no reason to ever hold this consultation.
John Rosa, I want to thank you very much for being with us. John Rosa, historian of South and Southeast Asia, speaking to us from Jakarta on this day that the president of Indonesia, a new president, has been chosen. His name is Gus Dur, and he is a Muslim leader in Indonesia. It was expected that Megawati Sukarno-Putri would win, the daughter of the founding president of Indonesia. But the real question is when the power of the military will be broken. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to our special look today, and it's a look at slavery in the United States and African history. Recent studies continue to show African Americans are affected disproportionately by poverty, mortality, and employment discrimination, mortality rates for treatable diseases. Just this past month, a study concluded black patients die from cancer at higher rates than whites, and still another study found employers still practice a form of racial profiling that prevents many African Americans from entering or moving up in the job market. Well, these and other findings continue to show the existence of institutional racism. Conservatives are continuing their efforts to dismantle affirmative action programs, arguing they're no longer needed. Many say the U.S. is unable to recognize and deal with contemporary racism because it's also been unable to deal with its past history of slavery and with slavery's legacy, which is what we're going to talk about today. We're going to begin by hearing from Dr. Ivan Van Sertima. He is a linguist and literary critic, a professor of Africana Studies at Rutgers University, also editor of the Journal of African Civilization. He spoke recently at a symposium at New York University entitled Slave Roots, The Long Memory.
I must confess I was a little surprised that I had been invited to speak at this conference because there are two things that I cannot deal with because of my psychological condition, slavery and primitives, slaves and primitives. I know, and I went to London University the first year, everything was about primitives. We knew nothing about the great achievements of Africans. At the end of the first year, I drank poison. I was unconscious for 3 days. When the doctors woke me up, the chief doctor said I had drunk enough poison to kill 3 Englishmen. I felt very good about that. And I have been moved, deeply moved by the presentations here today because I have not had the courage to face the fact of slavery because we were treated like slaves. In my country, we did not have the vote. The first time we had a vote, only rich people could vote. Okay, and the first time we had the vote, my father was running for a seat. I became a speaker for the first time because I wanted to make sure my father won. I was called the Red Angel. At that time, Dr. Jagan, some of you may have heard of him, he was considered to be a communist. He wasn't really, but he was very much involved in Russia because the Russians supported our independence movement. So much as we were afraid of becoming involved with communism, they put that tag on us in order to destroy us. We fought, we won. We won overwhelmingly because the British had so structured our constitution that unless we got 3/4 of the seats, we could not win because they had packed the upper floor with the British, etc. But we won overwhelmingly. We were in power for 133 days. We behaved like real people. The British grew afraid. They sent 2 battleships. We didn't even have guns. They sent 2 battleships. I never forget that morning. I'm sitting in the chamber. My father is speaking. And suddenly everything shakes. It's a wooden tongue. They start blasting off in the harbor to frighten us. And then troops followed from all over the Caribbean, from Britain, etc. Troops crowded in on us. For 4 years, we could not have a funeral, a christening, a wedding, unless at least 4 policemen were present. Nobody. This was one of the most horrifying periods of life. I have never gotten over it. Okay, and it was when I eventually emigrated, I went to Britain. There was no university in my country. All my great dream was to go to university. But you couldn't go to university. You had to come first for the whole country. unless you were stinking rich, and most of us were stink but not rich. Okay. And I tried three times. The third time I was sure I would come first for the whole country. And my mother died the week of the exam, so that was the end of my chances. So eventually I emigrated to Britain. Most West Indians went off to Britain because there wasn't enough jobs. And then I got in the British Information Services. The British never suspected me because I'm very fortunate. I have an odd name, Ivan Van Sertema. You can't have two Vans in the same name. And thank God my father did that to me, because I called myself, instead of Van Sertema, I called myself Ivan Sertema. So I was filed onto two different structures, so I was not suspected. So since I'd worked in the government information services, the British put me in their information services. And anything that was of value to my prime minister, I passed over to him. For example, when the Canadians were going to retreat and destroy our bauxite industry, my prime minister knew about it. So I was trusted, and I started to do Caribbean writers for the British, and it was translated into German and French. It went all over the world, and then my life changed, because suddenly I discovered Africa. We were trained to despise the African in us. Make no mistake about it. The West Indian was trained to despise the African in us. And suddenly I discovered Africa. That was so astonishing to me. I read Chinyo Achebe and Yambo Ulo Gulem and Kamarale and all. I could not believe, how could the African do this? How could Achebe recover a century when we in our shattered world could not even dream of doing that?
You're listening to Dr. Ivan Van Sertema, Professor of Africana Studies at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We're going to come back to him and a speech he recently gave on the slave trade at New York University here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In just a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with our special on slavery with Dr. Ivan Van Sertema, Professor of Africana Studies at Rutgers University, speaking recently at New York University on a conference entitled Slave Roots, The Long Memory.
So I started to read everything the Africans had done. So then I went to my superior officer in the Government Information Services. I had published Caribbean writers. The British had it translated into French and German. It was all over the world. So I said, now I've finished Caribbean writers, I would like to do African writers. African writers? There's no such thing. They don't even have a script. I said, sir, you do not have a script. The English have no script. It's Roman. The French have no script. It's Roman. The Germans have no script. It's Roman. Very few Europeans had a script. I said, forgive me saying this, sir, I don't mean any disrespect, but you were all ancient illiterates. The Romans conquered you and gave you a script. The Africans have as many scripts as Europe. They have the Akan script. They have the Manding script. They have the Meroitic script. They have the hieroglyphic script. They have half a dozen scripts. You don't have half a dozen scripts. He said, you may have a point. But we can't allow you to do that. I said, well, I'm resigning. No, 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 no. Remember where you are. you do not have a chance unless you stay with us. I said, well, I don't have a chance anyway staying with you. So I want to go. He said, no, 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 don't do that. You'll destroy yourself. Look, we will promote you. What will you promote me to? We'll make you head of the post room. I said, well, that's a good job, sir, but that's not exactly my dream in life. But what would you like to do? I'd like to go to university. You see, some of you here, you go to university, you don't realize how difficult it is. None of us could go to university. You had to come first for the whole country in order to, there was no university in our country. You had to go abroad to go to university. So he said, all right, in the light of all you've done, Van Sartama, we could arrange that. So I was so happy. Stupid man. I go there the first week. I'm at the house of Kong von Heimendorf. All these famous anthropologists are there. And then you start to study anthropology. Anthropology in Britain was the study of primitives. Boogaboos in the bush. They knew nothing about African achievement. They knew nothing about its astronomy and its metallurgy. They knew nothing. It was all going into the bush and studying primitives in the bush. At the end of the first year, I drank poison. I was unconscious for 3 days. When they woke me, they told me I drank enough poison to kill 3 Englishmen. I'll never forget that. I felt so good about that. And then came the change. I shifted completely. I started to do something, an African writer, somebody picked up on that, Dennis Jordan, Transcription Center. So I did something in African writers. And then eventually I completed my university degree and I started to do this, to extend this thing in African writers until Jan Carew, my friend, invited me to America. My prime minister invited me because they were celebrating independence. Burnham invited me. I was celebrating independence. And on my way home, Jan Carew, the professor at Princeton, Guyanese, he said, why don't you come to America? I said, no, 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 I've heard such dark things about America. I don't want ever to go there. He says, don't you worry. It's not worse than Britain. So I decided I will spend a weekend there and came on Saturday and Sunday. I was invited to join Douglas College, Rutgers University, and I've been there ever since. And the study of Africa became very important to me. I've been asked to speak on slavery, but I can't. What I will discuss is what was eclipsed by slavery. The scientific culture of Africa that was eclipsed by slavery, because few of us are aware of what Africans were involved in. The Africans had built, for example, the Africans were producing steel. No one on earth was producing steel. Schmidt, Peter Schmidt and Donald Avery of Brown University were able to show that Africans were producing steel 1,500 to 2,000 years ago on the western shores of Lake Victoria, Tanzania. They produced carbon steel. They produced it in forced draft furnaces, a method technologically more sophisticated than anything developed in the world until the mid-19th century. These Africans achieved temperatures of 1,800 degrees centigrade, which is 400 degrees higher than the highest reached in Europe. A record reached for Europe, a temperature in combustion zone was in a Roman blast furnace, 1,600, but afterwards, they never produced anything close to the African. The African steel was taken in ships in East Africa and transferred by traders to Europe. The finest swords made in Europe, Damascus swords, were made from African steel. They did not even know that. Then we found astronomical observatories in Kenya. Lynch and Robbins of Michigan State discovered an astronomical observatory in Kenya dated 300 years before Christ. It was found in the edge of Lake Turkana. They said the evidence attested the complexity of prehistoric developments in sub-Saharan Africa. They built the most accurate and complex calendar system in the world 300 years before Christ in eastern Africa. Then we discovered the Dogon. The Dogon 500 to 700 years ago, they knew things that are 20th century. They knew about the atom. They said everything was made up of invisible spinning particles. They knew the universe was expanding. They said the stars are running away from us. The people who studied them did not know what that meant. They thought it was fantasy. The stars are moving apart. The universe is still expanding. They knew about the Big Bang. They knew the moons of Jupiter, the spiral structure of the Milky Way. These are Africans living in the mountains. They knew this 700 years ago. They were studied very closely. And the star they fixed upon Sirius B is impossible to see with the naked eye. It's impossible to see the naked eye. They not only saw it, they started to say all sorts of things about it, which later we found out to be true. Then we found they had incredible architectural constructions. We found, for example, Great Zimbabwe. This is a stone city, about 900 years old. The wall around the palace of this city is 250 meters long. It is made up of 15,000 granite blocks of stone. 10,000 Africans lived in this city nearly 1,000 years ago. Europeans not only stole the treasures of this city when they came in, they also stole the right of the Africans to lay claim to what they built. Although it was made more half a thousand miles away from any seacoast, Europeans claimed it was built by the Persians, then by the Phoenicians, then by the Portuguese, then by the Arabs, then by the Chinese. All of them built it. And then we find major breakthroughs in a whole range of things. There are constructions that were extraordinary, like Great Zimbabwe, major constructions. But the thing that I got most interested in was their navigation. I lived on rivers. My father was superintendent of road and river transport. So when I was a boy, I swam 3 miles across the river. That was the only fun we had. There's no such thing as movies and things like that. So we just exercised. So I would swim across the river, etc. And my father was in charge of road and river transport, so we had a chance to see things that many people did not see. And we found that currents, most people do not know anything about water. Most people only know in cities, you know, water you drink. Water is colorless. There's blue water, green water, silver water, black water, red water. And then most people think water is still. In parts of my country, water runs faster than a motor car. You have to know how to steer or you'd be smashed against the rocks. In the Great Falls, the water runs faster than a motor car. And in certain places, all you have to do is to just stay like this and the water takes you a mile away. You just have to stay afloat, and boats can do that. And that is what led me to write They Came Before Columbus, because I realized that when we broke away from the sun, perhaps a million or so years ago, we split up, but we're still connected by currents. They're powerful currents that link Africa to America. Thor Heyerdahl discovered that. He didn't discover it, but he made use of it. Several people made use of it, showing that African boats could cross. The Baduma people on Lake Chad built a boat which Africans had built long before Christ. And they were able to cross with Thor Heyerdahl successfully, because even though we broke off as one burning ball, we split up, but we're connected by currents. This current off the Cape Verde, off the Senegambia coast, off the southern coast of Africa, that connects Africa to America. It's not only connected by currents, it's connected by winds. Americans discovered recently tons of African topsoil in South America. The wind blows soil from Africa and throws it all the way into America. So there are winds and currents. And several ventures have been made, several experiments to show that Africans could cross to America before Columbus. I didn't want to bring this in my lecture, but the new discovery has made all the difference. At last, we have several scientists have come over on my side. One of them, Einstein, when he was a young man, Bart Jordan. Einstein gave him special audience because he had phenomenal mathematical abilities. He startled NASA, for example. He pointed out certain things, and when NASA checked it out, they found it was true. Einstein gave him this special audience. But I do not understand mathematics, and every week he calls me and he gives me a long mathematical discourse. And I said, yes, Bart, yes. I do understand, but I don't understand a damn thing. I can't deal with that. Anyway, I want to close on something that you know little about. It's not just these Africans in Africa, but the Africans actually went up into Europe. And they had a profound impact on Europe. For example, Europe did not have parks. The Africans missed the green. That's how we have parks in Europe. Europe did not have a range of things. Europe did not have olives, almonds, vines. Europe did not have sugar, coffee, rice, cotton, lemon, syrup, soda, alcohol, all of those things Africans introduced into Europe, the Moors. And the Moors had a profound effect on Europe. And they introduced new musical instruments to Europe, the reed, the lute, the harp, a type of zither, the guitar, the oboe, the pastoral flute, two kinds of bagpipes, percussion instruments like the tambourine, castanets, brass rattles. They introduced a range of things. A black man, Ziryab, he's called Ziryab, the blackbird, because he was not only exceedingly black, but he had a musical voice, a melodious voice, so he's called the blackbird. He introduced crystal tableware to the Europeans. Europeans used to eat in one lump. He said, you have to split food up. First you have your soup, then your main meal, then dessert. I could go on for hours, but I think on that note I shall end. I just want to say it is not out of envy or hatred of any race that we sometimes seek to proclaim the great achievements of our own. We do this because we know that no race has a monopoly of intelligence or invention or enterprise, and because we know that the race of man is far from finished. There's a great deal left to be done in this world. The race of man is only just beginning. And there's room for all of us at the rendezvous of history. Thank you.
That was Dr. Ivan van Sertima, professor of Africana Studies at Rutgers University, also editor of the Journal of African Civilization. And now we turn to the great historian, Dr. John Henrik Clark, who died last year. Today we're going to bring you an excerpt of a documentary about his life that was done just before his death. The documentary is called A Great and Mighty Walk, and it is narrated by Wesley Snipes.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
How do you describe a legend? An African-American hero, an historian, an activist, who for half a century has charted a singular course dedicated to the intellectual and spiritual liberation of a people. Though his eyes are now darkened by glaucoma, he continues to enlighten the lives of thousands of men and women through the pages of his many books and in university classrooms across the country. How do you describe a legend? You can't, really. But you can meet the men and women who influenced him. You can learn from him the hidden history of the African people. Learn from him a different way of making sense of this complex and often very confusing world. And you can let Dr. John Henry Clark tell his own extraordinary story in his own soulful style.
I was born on a sharecropper farm in Union Springs, Alabama, New Year's Day, 1915. So I always had something decidedly different to say about my own people and about other people. No, I wanted to do something real, real big. So I went to a lawyer that I worked for before and after school. I can still remember his name, Gag Snyder. And I asked him for a book about my people in early world history. He says, I'm sorry, John, that you came from a people that have no history. My mind would not accept that. I continued to search, and I opened a book called The New Negro, and I opened to an essay called The Negro Digs Up His Past. And for the first time, I knew that I came from a very old people, that we were older than slavery, older than oppression, older than Europe. Now the scramble began for more information. The most valuable lesson I've learned is that when you address a people by their right name, that name must relate to land, history, and culture. All people go back to the geography of their original origin and identify themselves, no matter where they live on the face of the earth. We have overused the word black, because black tells you how you look, but it don't tell you who you are. You can call an Italian white, but that don't tell you anything about him. We are the only people who seem to have lost that all essential trait of geographical and historical reference.
You've been listening to a short excerpt of the documentary narrated by Wesley Snipes called The Great and Mighty Walk. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our look at slavery today. Sandra Green is Associate Professor of History and Women's Studies at Cornell University, author of Gender, Ethnicity, and Social Change on the Upper Slave Coast, and has been involved in UNESCO's Slave Route Project. Sandra Green gave the following presentation at New York University's recent conference, Slave Routes, The Long Memory.
When I received the invitation to participate in this conference, I looked at it. It said Slave Routes, The Long Memory, and I particularly focused on the notion of memory. I am an Africanist historian. I work almost exclusively in Africa, and I conduct my research in Ghana, in southeastern Ghana. And the area in southeastern Ghana that I work on is inhabited by a people who speak the Ewe language, and that community is called the Anglo. So you'll hear me talking about the Anglo Ewe or the Anglo. They were located on the coast, and they were very involved in the slave trade from the primarily from the 18th century on, and were even more deeply involved even as the slave trade began to end around the late 19th century. Sorry, the late 18th century. And so when I went to that particular community, I was really interested primarily in just documenting its history, but the whole notion of slavery and the slave trade kept coming up, first because it was such an intimate part of their history, but also because for a variety of reasons, they very much, many of the population knew about the connections between themselves and African Americans in this country in particular. I remember one time I was just walking down the street, and several men stopped me, and they said, "Oh, who are you?" And I explained that I was here, where I was from, that I came to do some research, and they said, "Oh, you're from America. You should definitely go to another town called Otoko, which is just down the road, because your ancestors came from that town. In fact, they came from this particular house, so you should definitely go there and check out your relatives." I was a bit surprised, because that kind of memory of the slave trade and its connections to African Americans is not very common. So when I looked at the subtitle, The Long Memory, that incident particularly came back to mind. The presentation that I therefore made for this conference focuses primarily on memory. There are many ways in which the Anglo remember and talk about the slave trade. And the title of my presentation is Gender, Geography, and Song, which is indicative of the way in which the slave trade and slavery in particular are remembered. There are various geographical sites that are associated with the slave trade. And this is a rural area. It's not where you have large numbers of Europeans trading. There was a Danish fort in the area, but there are towns that are locally remembered as being very involved, in particular families that were very involved in being involved in the slave trade, both in terms of being sellers, but also as being victims. And so there's a very interesting, nuanced memory of the slave trade in this particular area, not only about towns and families, but there's even remembered in song. There's songs that are recalled that were actually sung by slaves who were waiting their shipment. And these are very mournful songs, and these are still recalled in this particular area. But since this panel was focusing particularly on women and the slave trade, I decided that, at least for my remarks that I'm going to present right now, that I would focus primarily on how women are remembered in the slave trade in this particular area. Talking about the slave trade in many ways also brings up the issue of slavery, and you really can't separate the two. This particular area, as I mentioned, had been involved in the slave trade for a long time, and like many other areas in West Africa, there were twice as many males exported as females. In other words, if this community went to war and was engaged in capturing individuals, they didn't discriminate between combatants and non-combatants. The idea is to capture as many people as possible. And then those relatives who were not captured then could ransom the people back, and if you couldn't ransom or you didn't want them yourselves locally, you would sell them. So in that sense, you have a sense, you have war captives coming into this community, both captured by the people themselves and brought from other communities because these people were on the coast. So they were in a position to sell the Europeans. But invariably, twice as many men were sold as women, twice as many boys were sold as girls. And this is remembered locally, that it was that women were, if people were coming through as slaves to be sold, that we would rather go ahead and sell the men and the boys rather than the women, because the women were valued certainly for their labor, as Claire was mentioning. They can work, they can farm, they can, and that being a coastal area, they can be involved in processing fish, but they can also have children. And so therefore, they were valued both in terms of their ability to produce as well as reproduce. And this is, again, well remembered on this, in this community, that in fact women slaves were very highly valued. They were, and there were very many that were brought into this community. In doing family histories, for example, I was continually told that there's not a single family in this area that does not have descendants of enslaved women who are in it. Okay. So that you have a very strong gendered understanding locally in this area of southeastern Ghana about the way in which the slave trade operated and how that then translated into the character of the life on this, in the society itself, that you have a lot of slave women and their descendants within the community and within families. Now, the memories around that fact, this involvement, are, you might say, they're very, you can't reduce them to one single memory, whether it's shame, whether it's pride because we have a large family, including slave members, whether it's wanting to hide that fact. There are many different emotions associated with memories around the slave trade in this particular community, and many of them have to do with the fact that so many of the women slaves were women and remained in the area and then have their descendants. Now, this particular community, this society, is patrilineal. That is, they trace their descent through the men. But the reality, that's a fact, but the reality also is that, in fact, the status of a man is important, but the status of the mother is important as well. And so therefore, if an individual was born of a slave mother, there was a certain stigma attached to that. So that today, people can talk about the number of, that there are slave descendants in the family, but nobody would want to say exactly who it is, because there's a stigma around a slave descent, that somehow you were subject to that kind of control, you know, and not able to protect yourself. You didn't have any relatives around as such to protect you. And so there's a certain stigma associated. You can't get specifics. You can only say, yes, they are there. They're members of our family. There's also, over time, there also developed a particular concern not to say anything negative about slaves. Again, because these women are valued, their children were valued, they could produce and expand the influence of the family. And again, while everyone remembers that the slave trade operated and slavery operated, no one wants to get into the specifics. In the late 19th century, slavery was abolished by the British. That's when it began to take effect in the Anglo area. And in those instances, people who felt like they were mistreated could go home. You know, if you want to talk about me, you know, and you don't value me as a member of this larger family, that I'm contributing my labor, I have these children, I'll just go. If I remember where I come from, I will go back to where I came from. And believe me, plenty of people did. So there became a sense that you don't talk about these kinds of things. People value large families. The more people you have, the more you can produce. The more you can produce, the more you can sell. The more you sell, the more money you potentially can make, the wealthier the family is, the higher the status of the entire family it is as well. So there's a certain ambivalence about this. There is a sense that, yes, we like these people, but at the same, and we want them, they are part of us. At the same time, there's a stigma that somehow they're slave and they shouldn't be accorded the same rights as everybody else. And so people don't talk about these things, but when it comes into who is going to represent the family in a legal dispute or represent the family in some other kind of public gathering, who is going to be the elder? Who is going to, in a sense, take care of and deal with internal family disputes? Families look very carefully often at the backgrounds of the individuals. Is there any slave ancestry there? You know? And so therefore, people will get very sensitive about it, about talking about these kinds of issues. They recognize it, they know it's there, but they find it very difficult to talk about, especially in specifics. So there's a kind of a mixed reaction about the amount of slavery that's there. There's a certain amount of pride in having a large family, and yet to say that this individual is a slave, you know, that's insulting. The person may say, okay, we don't need you, then we'll just branch off and do our own thing. So there's concerns about family integrity that very much influence the way slavery is talked about in this particular area. You also have a certain amount of jealousy and competition that comes out because of the slave trade. People who were involved in the slave trade, many of them became very wealthy. And so when you go into these areas and you say, well, how did these people get their wealth and who are these people? Oh, well, you know, anyone who doesn't particularly like them will say, well, they were, you know, these people were involved in slave trade, but they were slaves themselves. So it's difficult to get, it becomes a, you hit somebody, you know, it becomes an insult. And so therefore, trying to get beneath that becomes very difficult. It also affects intra-family relations. Even though people don't really talk about it very much, there is a sense among some, and again, you get this because of the number of women who were slaves, that there's an inheritance pattern where both males and females inherit. Okay, a woman didn't have to be completely dependent on her husband. She could always inherit something from her family. Well, in Anglo, among the Anglo, it was often the case that when you have a man and he has several wives, that you have wives that were of slave origin and wives that were free and do have their children. And sometimes the father would say, well, in terms of the women of the children of my free wife, they can always go to her side of the family. She's got uncles, she's got brothers, etc. So whatever wealth that I have, I'm going to give it to the children of the slave women because they don't have any relatives. I bought this woman, we bring her in, she doesn't have anybody to support her, she worked very well for me, she produced children for me, so all of that wealth is going to go, I'm going to give the bulk of my inheritance to the children of my slave wife. And of course, believe me, that created quite a bit of dissension in families. Nobody can really say, well, you're a slave, and therefore I'm the one who should be inheriting this property. But there's these kind of underlying tensions within the families. Who's going to be head of the family? Who's going to inherit? Who has the right to inherit the bulk? On the basis of what? You also have women. A lot of oral traditions about the women who were involved as slave traders.
Sandra Green, Associate Professor of History and Women's Studies at Cornell University, author of Gender, Ethnicity, and Social Change on the Upper Slave Coast. And that is the end of today's program, Democracy Now!, which is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!